Attention, men and women, 50 and older. Are you uninsured? The Columbia Green Cancer Services Program offers free cancer screening tests. You could be eligible for free clinical breast exams, mammograms, pap smears, and colon tests. There are many local doctors to choose from. To find out more, please call the Cancer Services Program at 518-822-8741. Early detection is the best prevention. The Columbia Green Cancer Services Program is a program of the Healthcare Consortium and is funded by the New York State Department of Health Cancer Services Program.
WGXC will be on 90.7 FM in Greene and Columbia counties starting in June 2010. Beginning in May 2010, we will have an online version of the station at www.wgxc.org. WGXC will be a community-run media project. Re-envisioning radio as an innovative platform for local participation, our inclusive programming will connect diverse voices and distribute information across the public spectrum in New York's Greene and Columbia counties. To get involved, write to info@wgxc.org.
That's how every trip starts.
$175 off a picture ticket purchase to anywhere that U.S. Airways flies, domestic or international. There are no blackout dates, and it's also transferable. If your travel plans are flexible today, please see a customer service agent at the U.S. Airways ticket counter. Thank you.
The road. Holiday travel. Delays. On a cross-country trip to Louisiana. Flying down, driving back up.
To prevent the transporting of dangerous items without your knowledge, keep close watch on your baggage and personal items. For security reasons, unattended baggage may be inspected by the New York State Police. Parking is prohibited in front of the terminal, and violators may be ticketed or towed. TSA has limited the items which may be carried through the screening checkpoint. Please check with your air carrier for further information.
Studs Terkel's Hard Times, an oral history of the Great Depression on my knees. New appreciation for the true hardships of the road. Terkel interviewed everyone from dirt farmers to WPA administrators for a book that came out in the early 1970s. The road became the home for thousands of Americans at that time. Farmers lost their land and were forced to work as migrant workers. Prey to unscrupulous men who would cheat them out of the pittance offered for their back-breaking labor. Young men and women with no hope for a job, any job, hit the highways and hopped freights looking for honest labor. And beyond the obvious hardships, the road itself was different. Before the 1950s, traveling by car in America involved navigating a chaotic system of rutted roads that snaked its way across the country. There were fits and starts on creating a national interstate system before Congress passed the Federal Aid Highway Act of 1954, which set aside $175 million to begin constructing the system. I wondered about my mother's memories of travel during her childhood. She was born in 1932 and grew up on the plains, the daughter of a pastor.
And my parents didn't have much money, I know that. They never did. But I remember that we used to take trips every summer. My father had an old 1931 Chevrolet, and there were five children in the family, so it was a little bit crowded. It was maroon, what they called maroon that day, that time, and it was square. But we would start out, we lived in a town called Groton, South Dakota, and we would go to visit my parents' families in Minneapolis, Minnesota. It was always in the summer, so it was very hot. And of course, back then there was no air conditioning. And then the bad part was, we rolled down the windows, we got attacked by bugs. So very quickly into the trip, we would start the old question that has now become kind of a joke, I guess you'd say. Are we almost there yet? And so my parents would patiently, at least first, maybe later it became impatiently, explain that no, we were not there yet. It was still quite a long way. And actually the distance in miles was about 400 between the town that we lived in and in Minneapolis back then. And this was in the 1930s and 40s. And back then, they didn't have the same kinds of places to stop as we do now, of course. So on the first part of the journey in the prairie areas, we always would stop to go to the bathroom at a little one-room country schoolhouse. We would have our little picnic lunch. It was always peanut butter and jelly sandwiches until, as I got older, I could not, and to this day, stand peanut butter and jelly together. But it was an easy kind of sandwich. It didn't spoil in the heat. Now, as I got older and we moved to another place, we went to some of the national parks. And once I remember, probably as a teenager, we stopped. It was July. We'd gone to one of the state parks. I think it was Yellowstone. And while we were there, it began to snow. And I remember one of the pictures that he took of us standing, throwing snowballs at each other in the middle of the summer, which was very strange to us, needless to say, coming from the prairie. So my parents were, it was very important to them to let us see as much of the country as we could. And so we went to many different states. When I got older, we moved to Minnesota, and then we had a 1946 Ford. At that time, there were still no places to stop on the side of the road like we have now on the interstate, in the interstate system. And so my parents would think of things for us to do to keep us occupied while we were on the road. And one of the main things was counting how many cars were from what state, whatever state. We would look at all these cars, try to count who could find the most out-of-state license plates. And then we would have a contest. And every time we came to a cemetery, it would erase all of the things that we'd found.
I interviewed her in her bedroom in Louisiana, surrounded by boxes, in the midst of packing up a house filled with memories. Back home in southwest Louisiana, an area settled by a group of people who had a deep understanding of the road. History of the Cajun people starts in 17th century Canada, in what would become Nova Scotia. The area was ceded by the French to England in 1713. As Catholics living in a Protestant land, the Acadians were mistreated before finally being thrown out of their homeland, where they had lived for close to 150 years. The main migration was to Louisiana and ended around 1785. The Acadians, settling in Bayou country, created a hybrid culture that incorporated diverse elements from French, Native American, African, and Caribbean influences. Their food and music became distinctly Cajun, like nothing else in America or the world. My buddy Alan LaFleur, Cajun, who spent a long time playing rock and roll before returning to the music of his people. This is his band, the Lost Bayou Ramblers.
I've been down the road once or twice. Considering that we put about 48,000 miles per year on our van, and we fly to more than half of our gigs. We play 120 dates per year on average, and locally we play about half of those within the tri-state area, so we don't have to go too far. So out of every 6 weeks, we have one weekend off. We're traveling every other possible weekend. The worst part about being typically the food. Being from South Louisiana, every time you leave the house, you go somewhere else that doesn't have food as good as home does. We go to Austin, Texas a lot. So we hit Texas, Austin, as often as we can. We used to hit the Northeast up to New York and back a lot. Now it's been less. It's been a lot of Midwest trips, a lot of Canada trips. I leave Monday for France. It's been a lot of that. We're in all over Europe in May. Oh, we have our stops.
Yeah.
Okay. It's like religion. There's this one barbecue joint that just closed down because of construction right outside of Beaumont. It's probably the best barbecue that was ever, that we've ever had anywhere in the country, and it's gone now. It's been kind of like a tragedy. I had a job that was a career. Just became my career. My dad was in the military. He went everywhere. But I'm not far behind.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been in more places in Europe. I'm going to China soon. I'm right behind him. There was two really fun ones. One was in New York, and it happened to be with Andrew Amelinx. when we went and we stayed for like a week. That was just a spectacular trip the whole time there. The road trip up, being in D.C. and all these places, went to this great festival in Richmond on the way home. It was a Richmond Folk Festival. Well, it was the National Folk Festival then. And the whole time it was like being with family everywhere we went. And it was really, that was a spectacular trip. Another one was, we did this one when we used to have an RV and we'd travel in. We left Louisiana, went all the way down 40 to San Francisco. Hung out there for a week and then went up, like in that area for a week, and then started going north. And ended up in Ferndale, California, on this milk farm, and hanging out in the redwoods and camping, and ended up back in coming back through Nevada and all these spectacular places. That entire trip was like a bunch of brothers going on this adventure, total adventure. None of us got arrested. No one got anyone pregnant. No one did, you know, nothing bad happened.
Yeah.
None of us hated each other at the end of it. It was just one of those trips to remember. The very first trip that I can recall, it was kind of weird because I think it was in Toledo Bend, Louisiana. And from there, I think we went to Galveston. But I was a little kid and there was horses involved. And I thought that John Denver was there. And I thought this for years and years and years. And what it was a guy, a lookalike, that was playing John Denver tunes at this camp. And so for the next 15 years of my life, I thought John Denver was there until my dad goes, no, no, no.
Trip back was slow, and we spent time talking about other trips, other times, as we rolled north towards home, 1,500 miles away.
We are leaving Tuscaloosa, Alabama, heading towards Asheville, North Carolina.
I was in my early 20s, and a friend Lisa and I decided to go on a road trip, and we left Virginia. Our goal, for some reason, was New Mexico. We heard that Taos, New Mexico, was the place that we were going to live. I had never been to California, so I wanted to eventually go all the way to California. But first, we were just going to get out to Taos. But we decided to drive up the East Coast. So we loaded my little Nissan Sentra with no AC and just a radio. And my dad asked me if we wanted to take a gun with us, which is something that he's asked on a couple occasions, if I wanted a gun or a dog or something for protection. But Lisa had a big knife that she kept with us because we camped most of the way. So we drove up the East Coast, stopping in New York City, stopping in Massachusetts, Maine, and we camped most of the ways. And since it was all season, I think we left in October. All the campgrounds were pretty deserted, so it was a little creepy. But then again, we never really had to pay for anything. We just kind of pulled up and camped. And we drove we went to Quebec, Old Quebec City, and then we drove to, we camped outside of Montreal, and then we went to New Lisker, Ontario, and down until we got to Colorado, and we reached up to Boulder, and we just, it was a beautiful day, and we decided to live there. And Lisa stayed there for, I think she stayed there for like 10 years. And I stayed there for 1 year, and then I decided that I still wanted to go to California, so I loaded up my little Nissan Sentra and drove by myself through to California. And then I continued down to L.A. I had a friend in L.A. And then I drove all the way across Texas, which without an AC in August, it was pretty miserable. And this was before cell phones or anything, so I was just totally out of touch. Everybody. Which I would never, I think I would never be able to do that now.
How long did the trip take?
A month. Lacey and I drove cross country a couple times together, and one of the times we made up this radio game where if either of you, if you had to be honest, because you couldn't say that you didn't know a song if you knew the words to a song. So if you knew the words to a song, you had to sing it, and you stayed on that radio station until neither of you knew the words to a song that was playing or was a commercial, and then you would search for the next radio station that was playing a song that you knew the words. So we basically sang all the way from Virginia to Colorado. I've driven to Colorado a few times, because after I came back from Colorado, I was here in Virginia for a year, and then I moved back out to Colorado. And I drove back by myself to move back to the East Coast, and I did, it's a 30-hour drive, and the first day I did 10 hours, and then the second day, I meant to stop after 10 hours. I started looking for a hotel, but all the hotels were full because there's some sort of race or something. So at my 10-hour mark, I couldn't find a hotel, so I just kept driving and driving. And then it was like, oh, well, now I'm only 6 hours away from home. You know, it's kind of silly to stop now. So I just kept driving and ended up doing 19 hours by myself. The trips I took as a child, I remember, I kind of associate two things with that. That's Juicy Fruit gum and being car sick. So now anytime I smell Juicy Fruit gum, I think of being car sick. So it's, I just really can't eat it, chew it.
Yeah. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this program do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities.
It's really funny, though, early in the morning, just some cars looking at me one at a time. Is that guy doing on the side of the road? I got my flashers on, I'm even doing right-hand delivery. I'm doing right-hand delivery. He's got the directional on. I can't get any more off the working road. What's he doing on the side of the road?
I'm going to Island to the Sunset Strip. Somebody's gonna make a happy trip tonight while the moon is bright.
Hey, hey, listeners. It's Christmas Eve again. Come 3 o'clock in the morning, Santa won't be the only dude running around making deliveries. I'll be out on the road, too, delivering the holiday weekend edition of the local daily to subscribers in and around Germantown, New York. Delivery people drive around the clock every day all year long, if you ever see what they're up to. I do a lot of thinking thanks to the newspaper route, driving the dirty back roads wound around in between state highways 9 and 9G. To make it from one pre-dawn journey to the next unscathed, you stay alert, receptive, amp up your intuitive faculties. Of course, mindlessness doesn't have to mean mind-numbing, but this is the kind of routine that reminds one there is a difference between a job and real work. Today we're going to hear from a few people whose vision hangs hard by the road. Photographer Victoria Sanbenares hits the road every year, scouting industrially altered landscapes, wielding large format film cameras to render a moment's vision worth sharing with other people. Retired retail manager James McMullen bought his first motorcycle at the end of the summer after graduating from high school in Western Pennsylvania nearly 50 years ago. He'll be out riding again next summer. Columbia Green student Ursula DePue hungers for the road in her soul. She's driven cross-country more than once with friends and with lovers, and not only lived to tell about it, but plans to start all over again, this time farther afield.
Gonna have a bag of crazy toys to give the cronies, of girls and boys. So dig, Santa comes on big.
I used to believe that saying, you know, like people on the road at 3 o'clock in the morning are drunk, truckers, and police officers. And then I realized different people at a moment.
One of those categories.
Trust me, I've seen my share of drunks, though. Holy crap. Mm-hmm. I'm like, where's a cop when you need him? I haven't been stopped in, like, forever. Ever since I told that state trooper off, they kind of, like, leave me alone. I drive right by the trooper barracks, too. I don't even see troopers when I'm stopped at Extra Mart. I hate delivering the frickin' trailer park ones in the dark, because I'm picking, like, I'm hunting lawn gnomes. I don't, they, like, jump out at me. Constantly tripping over something. Or booting a solar light that's not even on. Lawn gnome.
When I just went from here to New Mexico, that was the very first time, and we went by way of Interstate 70, I think, which goes through Missouri and Kansas and into Colorado. And we were visiting a cousin of mine who was living in Colorado Springs. First, I remember driving through the time change, which was weird. I had never, like, noticed it. So clearly we had been driving all night. And it was, like, about 10 in the morning. And we stopped for breakfast and got out and realized that it was now 9 in the morning at this little, like, diner. And then, yeah, and it had changed, you know, overnight into, like, real true desert, real true Colorado desert. And then, yeah, I remember coming into Colorado Springs, and you can see the mountains from a ways off. I feel like every time I've come into Colorado from the east, it does, it almost, like, drops down. You almost feel like you're up high. And then as you go toward the mountains, you sort of descend a bit before, you know, the mountains start and you go back up. Colorado Springs is, like, right, more so than Denver or Fort Collins, it's right in the shadow of the mountains. And they're just, like, looming the whole time, and it's really, really something spectacular to see. And my age coming back with power. I'm big. And there's one road that runs north to south through the top, the high plains in the Rockies. It's not like a interstate or anything, it's just a highway, two-lane highway. I remember being on that road for a week and a half straight. I mean, if we had gone straight without stopping, it would have been a lot quicker, but there's nobody up there. It's just the road and the plains and the elk, and every maybe like 50 miles, 60 miles, a little tiny shop with a gas station, and the peaks of the mountains around you. And it was a really, really intense experience. We bought some bacon in one of those little shops that turned out later to be like 8 months expired or something like that. And it made sense. It felt like that was about how often the distribution truck would get there. It was so isolating in such a weird way because it was so beautiful and it was so fun. But at the same time, when we came down, when we slowly started to descend by the time we were like at the south end of the mountain range, I just remember towns started to sort of get closer together. And I just remember like finally realizing that we were out, that we had like come through. We were like back to civilization, and being so happy to see people and to see like, I don't know, just people. We weren't sure if we were going to come back or just stay somewhere. I was like 20. I don't think I was even 21. The next time that I really did it, it ended up being like 5 months in a van. It was scary. We thought, let's end up somewhere. Let's find a destination. Once you're in that mode, like even places that seem like they could be pretty cool make you think, well, maybe there's somewhere even cooler, like, you know, right over the next hill, right around the next bend. And we just wanted to keep going, I guess. Actually, you know what that made me think of is in being in, I can't remember whether it was Glacier National Park, which is like all the way on the Canadian border, or whether it was Yellowstone, which is on the border of Wyoming. And then there's also whatever one is in Jackson Hole. I can't remember. I've been to like all of them. Anyways, one of those two northern parks, we met a guy. It was like about 100 degrees out. We were driving through the park, and they're glacial. We're driving along, and suddenly there was this ravine across the road where there was 3 feet of snow, and all these people pulled over, hanging out and playing in it, throwing snowballs and stuff. And we stopped, and we were looking, and we met this old guy. He was just standing by the fence, you know, overlooking this ravine, just sort of like wistfully staring out. He just sort of started talking to us, saying, "It sure is beautiful, isn't it?" And, you know, we kind of agreed. And he just sort of started volunteering how he had worked in the park when it was being built. He'd, like, worked for the Parks Association and CCC, I think, something like that. He just volunteered all this information about how he helped build the road through, what it used to look like, how many men they'd lost in building the park because of these little mountainside roads overhanging deep ravines and stuff. And he also told us the week before there'd been a grizzly bear and how there'd been a bunch of people like throwing stuff at it. And like kids and like the parents were like egging them on, like telling them to go throw stuff at the bear. He couldn't even like put into words how ridiculous that was. He just sort of like shook his head and was sort of like how people have changed, how dumb people have gotten. We tend not to think about how grand our country is, how much territory, how much land it encompasses. And we think of France as a country, we think of the United States as a country, we think of England as a country, we think of Spain as a country. However, the United States is like five times the size of any of those, you know? And so all these different people who come from such like different places, different to be like all ruled under one umbrella is a strange thought. I mean, you know, I don't know. It doesn't make sense when you see it. Beautiful like lush green trees just like give way in the space of like 2 hours to like brown plains with these like rolling hills and these like straight roads into like who knows where. It just becomes clear, like, why would somebody who lives in that place with those issues and that climate and that thing, like, have the same government or whatever as people with completely different issues? I don't know. I think it's too big. I think it should be split up. The biggest thing that I got personally was a sense of appreciation for varied geographical locations, you know, like, different than the one you have grown up knowing or have spent most of your life knowing or whatever. I think it's as awe-inspiring for me to pull into Colorado Springs and watch a 3 p.m. rainstorm emerge out of the blue and knock up against the Rocky Mountains, drop its load, and then like dissipate. And I think that's as awe-inspiring for me as it would be for a kid from there to come here and drive down the country roads in August at dusk and see the fireflies and the green and lushness. You know what I mean?
Right after graduation, I drove across the country with a painter, and it was my first time going west across the country, and I could not believe that I was leaving, and I knew my work was cut out for me. We started out East Coast, Pennsylvania picked me up, and then we started driving west. And this southern group, and we were going to LA, and I had my camera, in the car, and every single, I didn't take one picture because I was completely overwhelmed with what I was seeing. Somehow, when you cross the Mississippi and you keep going west, things start to open up. Things are spread out. The sky is open. The landscape is broad. There, you can see forever in some areas. I remember seeing, driving through, I think we were in Amarillo, Texas, and seeing trains in the distance and seeing lightning in the sky, seeing lightning, and it was incredible what I was seeing and discovering on that trip. It made me realize that there was this other world to explore going west. I've been on the road consistently every year, 7 or 8 months a year. And I had a dog at the time. So in the early years, I put the equipment in, the dog, attach it, and I hit the road. I had a Subaru wagon, but then I totaled that. up in the Hudson area, I was in Lake Barrington area, and I hit a concrete wall. Once I'm driving west, I start to relax, and the only anxiety is the anxiety of the work, and everything else is pure. I love those extremes. I love the surge. My whole mental state changes when I'm on the road, when I'm west. And I can't explain it. Initially, I wasn't really quite sure what I was looking for. And I was just exploring with no preconceptions. If I stumbled upon it, I would just go with it. When I was doing the Yellowstone Project with the geologist, I learned so much about the formation of this area and what was going on. I started to look at the changing Earth and really trying to understand the landscape. What has happened here as opposed to reacting to whatever it was, what I was seeing. Alaska really expanded my world in ways that I couldn't imagine. And the trip that I had to learn how to camp to be fearless, it took me 11 days to get up to Alaska. There were no cheap hotels to stay in. I had to dive into it. I'm in pure wilderness. There aren't many people. I guess I had to really learn to be alone on that trip, to be comfortable with yourself. Because when you are feeling secure, you're much more open. You're open to people. That expands your world in ways you can't imagine. I think after that, I started looking at the geology of the landscape differently and how we're developing the landscape. The road is the constant. It's the venue. It's what takes you to another place. The road varies. The road can change. The road can be, it can be a very solitary place too. Especially when you're in your car alone on the road. It's the place that did not feel this calm. I'm in my car on the road, your windows looking out at the world. And then once I take an exit, you know, the real work begins of having to explore and find whatever it is that I'm looking for. It offers me comfort, like I do, like driving. But the road can be very surprising, too. So many times when I'm on the road, I'm seeing things off the highway that, you know, I'd love to just pull over and shoot from that perspective, but that's difficult sometimes because the road doesn't allow you to do that. There was a time when I had my had a video camera attached to the dashboard, and I was videotaping the road, and I have so much footage of just the road. You know, the roads never change, but the landscape around it changes. I've already seen that. I go back to particular places, and I can't believe how towns have changed, how they've evolved. Sometimes I can't even recognize them. But the one thing that I stress to everyone is get off the road and get into the town. You know, make sure you're not just on the road, and on the highway. That's when the world opens up.
Musician.
It's about self-discovery and learning about yourself and your place in the world. And I tend to move around a lot, never in one space. And some people see that as escaping something within myself. But I get excited about the journey because sometimes life begins to feel stale. Going on a journey is almost rediscovering yourself and evolving yourself, enlightening yourself. And it's not easy. Most people don't want to tackle those issues within themselves. It's almost meditating, maybe, or it's challenging. Not so much to be with yourself, but to be with yourself in a new environment is another layer. That's the journey. You know, you're in the car, there's a lot of time for thinking, and not everybody you encounter is a murderer, racist. You know, the media is still here because that's what sells newspapers, and that's what gets people to watch television, kid that murdered his family, or they still fear in people, like these horror stories. But I've learned to get away from that, the fear is in your mind. And, you know, I can't by myself, and people think that's so crazy that you do that. It's not, why? I mean, I'm out in nature. Sometimes there are people around me, sometimes not. That's a big challenge, is to remove the fear, get rid of it, block it, and then the world becomes a better place and is much more interesting. And waking up outside. And I love that whole ritual. Drinking my camp coffee and having time, which we start to lose time with. I start to lose time when I'm back east. I think that having that confidence and being friendly, being more in touch with the world, I think people that, and it makes them more comfortable about who you are, and then things begin to open up. You trust them, they trust you, and the world is at your fingertips. You know, it's right there for you. People have invited me into to their homes and deciding to stay. But without the road, my work wouldn't exist.
That's Vicky Sambunaris, photographer. Excuse me. She's out in the New Mexico wait right now on a residency in Santa Fe and will be returning. We'll be returning. Sorry about that technical glitch. We'll be returning to the East Coast to show her photographs, large format color photos of the American landscape at Yancey Richardson Gallery in February, the end of February. That's in New York City, Yancey Richardson Gallery.
So you've been listening to Difficult Histories with Norman Douglas and Ann Ramelix.
We have a few more minutes of airtime here, so we're going to speak spontaneously. Unscripted, live radio.
That's what it's about, I guess. That's what we're here for. I wanted to. I guess we let's. If you have any good road stories, thought we might fill some time with your.
Do I have road stories? I have road stories that will last all day long. I've been on the road my entire life until I moved to. Well, I moved to Columbia County. I've been a roadie. Well, not a music roadie, but I've been on the road. I've been across the country with Vicky Sambunaris. It was my first trip. But before that, I was up and down the coasts. I always flew in between, but up and down the California highways, up and down the East Coast. Made my way to Mexico, where I wrecked two cars. Volkswagens, very cheap down there, made in Brazil, $500 a piece. Probably the most expensive purchases I've ever made in cash in my life.
Wow.
Maybe excluding other nefarious things. Paris, road tripped through Europe from Paris to Italy, Tuscany. To Switzerland, Dusseldorf, Berlin, back across to Paris, road trips through Norway, made a lot of road trips, down from Prague to Vienna, stories I could tell.
speaking of Europe, I was in Spain, and my Spanish is pretty non-existent, and the trains sometimes they split and you start in one main train and then as you're traveling, half the train goes one way, half the train goes the other way, and the woman was trying to explain to me that I needed to be on in one half of the train to get where I was going, but there's obviously a communication problem, and so she wakes me up in the middle of the night and she goes, gotta go on the other train. And we were pulling into the station and I thought she was telling me that I had to get off the train and get on another train, and so I get off in the middle of nowhere in the middle of the night and the train pulls away and I'm like, oh, I think I made a mistake. And so I go over to the train station, talk to the two of the guys that work there, and one speaks a little bit of English and the other speaks a little bit of French, and I speak way more French than I do Spanish. So between the three of us, we kind of figured out what had happened. but there was no train until the next day, and they didn't have any taxi service in this town. So he's like, we're calling the police. I'm like, what? He's like, oh, no, 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 no. We're not arresting you. The police will give you a ride to the hotel. So they picked me up, and the ride there was weird because, like, it's the back seat of at least the cop the cop cars there are made out of hard plastic.
Oh yeah.
It's like a subway seat. It's kind of weird. But on the trip there, one of the guys spoke, the cop spoke pretty good English, and he asked me, he's like, "Is my English pretty good?" I said, "Yeah, your English is good." And then in Spanish, he told the other cop, he sort of bragged, he's like, he said, "My English is good." And anyway, so it was. Well, the next day I get on the train and almost did the same thing. They were two different conductors were telling me two different parts of the train that I needed to get onto. It was a mess, but I finally reached my destination a day late. It was the best hotel I stayed in.
Yeah, it's funny. It's funny how the road will often, if you're on a trip, you'll often get stuck in a place by yourself, completely and utterly alone, and even if it's in the States, just having no clue of where the hell you are or what to do next. And that's one of the curious things about the road. I was looking up in the one of my reference books. I was looking for the road in the dictionary of symbols, but there is no entry for the road. There's an entry for the journey, and it talks about how the traveler is an exalted one in the Islamic religion and the Chinese, and well, generally they talk about all the authors of this are a couple of deceased French researchers. They have a huge bibliography, but they talk about how all of the journeys that are undertaken by heroes and men like King Arthur and the Holy Grail, and they basically are fruitless. You know, Odysseus returns home. But because what they're all doing is escaping from the self in search of the self. And because they make that fatal flaw of trying to escape from themselves in order to find themselves, they don't find their grail, or they don't find their, I think in Chinese, it's the center of the earth, which represents, you know, the center of the self. And I think both a few people kind of touched on that idea, especially I think Vicky talking about how a lot of people see her as escaping herself because she's traveling every summer, where she acknowledges the difficulty of being with and by herself and not only at home but in another place. And then, you know, she does make the return on a regular basis, but often when I've spoken with her about the return home, it seems like the most difficult part of her trip.
It is definitely a weird adjustment period, you know. It's always strange to, like, go away for, I mean, even if it's a weekend or something, or especially if it's longer, come back. And, you know, when you get back, you're sort of starting from the point at which you left, but everyone else's life is continuing on. And you, to you, there isn't a necessarily a gap of time when, you know, being back home, while, you know, life is actually sort of continued on, you know, it's a merry way without you.
Yeah, I think, I guess I did come up with the road mostly because this was an idea, a theme that I came up with on my own, and Andrew agreed to it. The next one on the fourth Friday of January will be family, which is, a fusing together of ideas that both of us had. But I think the reason I came up with it was because I'm driving around all the time here in the county delivering the paper which Andrew writes for. And there's even in that period, a span of about 3 to 4 hours that I'm driving around the county, there is that kind of self-reflection that I go into often inadvertently, you know, I'll have the music blasting and it'll get to a point where the iPod runs out of batteries or the CD ends and I have to change it or something. You know, the radio puts on a lousy song and I can't find anything on, so I slam it off in exasperation and and there I am, you know, I return to myself. And I guess that's sort of what I was hoping to arrive at by asking people about the road. I did announce that there was an interview with James McMullen, and I apologize. Technical difficulty did not allow that interview to go on. But the program will be archived, wgxc.org, the next week or two. Check the website for that. And the earlier episode of Difficult Histories, and for other shows. And all the other cool stuff. Become an underwriter. Give money.
Yeah.
Listen, tell your friends. We were supposed to be on the air. We'll be on the air next month. The antenna is up and working, so local people can hear it as well as people on the interweb.
Right.
We're down to a minute and a half. The red light is blinking.
All right.
So we want to thank both of you for listening. And, and all of you for listening in the future. Don't forget to support WGXC. Don't forget to stop by the current station when you have a chance here at
check it out, for sure.
700 block of Columbia Street in Hudson, New York. There is a landline now. I don't know what the number is. I wish I could tell you.
There it is.
Oh, there it is.
518-828-0290.
That's 518-828-0290. So call in. Find out what's going on at WGXC.org. Program of Transmission Arts. WGXC is a hands-on community radio station supported by people throughout the community and hopefully around the world.
Hopefully just like you.
We're close. We're going to switch. I think we're going to come in. We're going to switch you into a song now.